Why do we drink what we do? Why do some drinks become classics while others languish at the back of the drinks cabinet?
Is it just because we prefer those drinks, or are there underlying economic, social or technological trends that shape our choices?
And that's what we're going to explore on A Question of Drinks.
Join us as we explore the hidden side of the drinks cabinet, the decisions, reversals and underlying forces that shape the beverage market. I'm Luli Halstead.
And I'm Felicity Carter. And together we host A Question of Drinks.
So hello, Felicity. Great to see you. And how are you this week?
I'm good. And I should note that for once, we are recording this episode without either of us having jet lag or travel fatigue.
Indeed, I know. It's really unusual, isn't it? Neither of us have travelled this week. So I think that probably is about a first for us. Anyway, so I'm actually at home, have been all week. And so I have had the opportunity to reacquaint myself with my kitchen.
Oh, I see. And what great culinary creations have you been making while you've been grounded?
Okay, so I actually bothered to make homemade Bearnaise sauce, which I heroically rescued from the brink of curdling, which was very close. But what about you? How have you been making use of your home time?
I just want to tell you about a friend of ours who made a Bearnaise sauce, and we discovered the way she did it is before serving, she'd dash out to the local restaurant and get some of theirs and bring it back.
Having made it, I think that's a really good idea. And I like it. Yes. Carry on.
Okay, so I've decided that I need to recapture my attention. Like everyone else, my attention is fragmented by social media. So I've been immersing myself in books. I've been reading this fantastic book called The Alchemy of Air about, get this, the development of fertilizers. And it's surprisingly riveting.
Okay, there's so many questions I could ask, so I'll just go with why.
Well, the process for creating fertilizer, it's called the Haber-Bosch process. Basically changed the world. It's the only reason that we've got such a big population today, because we can grow enough food.
Okay.
But they developed it not far from where I live, and there was a historic explosion in 1922 that killed like 560 people on the spot. And
Gosh.
You know, you could feel it, you know, a long way away. So now, anyway, it's a really historic thing. So I'm thinking about going out there to see where it all happened when I have a chance. It's just a train ride away.
Okay. So is there like a whole new tourism thing, like local fertiliser
tourism? No, I'm going to start it. I'm going to be the first one.
That's a new business for you. New business.
So yeah, fertiliser tourism.
Yeah. So as long as, along with nearly curdling Bearnaise sauce, I've also had time to catch up on my very now growing back catalogue of Economist issues. And there was, as always, so many great articles, but there was one particularly back in the 3rd of July issue. And it was entitled Kim Kardashian, Ryan Reynolds and the Age of the Celebrity Brand. So it got me thinking about a question actually for this week's episode. So let's just contextualize this in drinks where, for example, you know, George Clooney has made up to supposedly $1 billion from his tequila. Kylie Minogue has 16% of the UK sparkling wine market in just over 4 years since launch, and Ryan Reynolds has flipped a gin brand for hundreds of millions.
So the question that I immediately think of is, how can we build a celebrity brand that costs $1 billion?
Okay.
But I'm sure the question that you're actually going to ask is, are celebrity drinks brands selling you something worth drinking, or are they just a story?
Absolutely, exactly. So we can use my tried and tested framework grand title for two different points of view, red corner and blue corner.
I love this framework, Lily.
I know, I'm still quite proud, so that's why we're using it again. Anyway, so we've got two points of view that we can examine this from. So we've got the blue corner, i.e. celebrity brands are selling you something real, and the red corner, they're just marketing hype.
Right, but before we do this, we've had quite a bit of feedback on our last episode on taste, and the feedback has been very passionate, both positive and negative.
Yes, you're right. We have. I love the fact that we had so much engagement on the episode, and as you say, passionate, both positive and negative.
Yes.
So we were called out, Felicity. We were called out on our oversimplification when we said that 80% of taste is gained through aroma, through smell, versus 20% that comes via our taste buds. So, Felicity, did we get it wrong? And should we be big and gracious enough to admit we made a mistake?
Never. We are never going to admit we made a mistake.
Oh, okay.
So we didn't get it completely wrong. What we did was we oversimplified the situation. Mm. The quote 80% smell, 20% taste line gets repeated a lot because it's nice and sticky, not because it's precise.
Mm.
So research shows smell is dominant in flavour perception, but the exact percentage shifts depending on the method that's being tested. So some studies put smell's contribution about 70%, others are as low as 50% once other factors are factored in.
Yeah.
So yes, we rounded up a bit too enthusiastically.
Okay. So that's sort of semi-admitting that we...
No, it's not. We admit nothing.
Okay, we admit nothing. Okay, okay, got it. I've got the party line. Okay. So whilst we're in open mode and receiving, shall we call it the gift of feedback, also had feedback.
The gift of suffering. Yeah,
gift of feedback. We also had feedback questioning our comments around how we as humans haven't evolved an extensive language or lexicon to describe tastes and flavour, and in particular when it comes to describing wine. So did we get that one wrong?
I'm going to admit to this one that yes, and it was me that got this wrong.
Oh,
so
yeah, that's very big of you, Felicity.
Oh, well, no, this is a really, really important one to get right, because it is true, but it's true for European populations.
Right.
So compared to vision or colour, humans in general do typically have a less standardised vocabulary for flavour, but there are some cultures that have a much more sophisticated lexicon for odours. So it's Western languages that never developed these rich shared vocabulary for flavours the way they did for colours. Now, the problem is that wine culture has tried to fill that gap with its own descriptors, and that's often what makes wine come across as arcane and pretentious.
Okay, okay. So that's very big of you to admit that, and also to share that bit about the Western culture is sort of super interesting. But on the plus side, we did get lots of positive messages, didn't we? Including a lovely mess from
you
one.
You didn't pass those on. Thanks, Lily.
Okay. I saw lots of positive messages because I read the inbox. Anyway, including one from one of our lovely regular listeners, Sarah. So she said, now that she's listened to the episode on taste, she's going to buy cheap wine when she's entertaining her guests because they'll be enjoying themselves so much that they'll think the wine is fab too.
Oh, that's great. We've changed the world and made it just that little bit better, Lily.
I know.
By the way, I saw an article in the New York Times saying that Tinto di Verano, which you talked about last time, is now the drink of summer. You are ahead of the curve.
Did I set the trend? Maybe I set the trend. Who knows?
Maybe you did. Maybe it was you.
Yes. Anyway, so back to celebrities. Now we fessed up or not to the previous feedback. So our question, are celebrity drinks brand selling you something worth drinking or just a story? So we've got this blue corner view, which is basically, yep, they're real, they're worth drinking. And we've got the red corner view, which says, no, it's all hype.
And because I'm naturally contrarian, I'm going to take the red corner.
I never thought that. So let's contextualise this just in the context of celebrity brands, kind of in general, but this is also happening in drinks as well, that according to JLL, a research report that came out, 60% of all US celebrity retail brands were founded in the last, get this, 6 years. So this is such a kind of growing phenomenon, I guess partly why the economists were, you know, talking about it.
God, that's huge. I mean, that's a lot of star power, Chardonnay and tequila to get through.
Absolutely, exactly. So before we hit the red and blue corners, I was hoping, as our resident history correspondent, that you would take us through some of the kind of backstory and history of celebrity drinks brands. And I am guessing, Felicity, that inevitably you have written an article about it.
I didn't. Believe it or not, I never did.
No.
But my colleague Robert Joseph did.
Okay.
And he also, at one point he was giving great presentations on the subject. So I asked him for his notes.
Okay. Well, hopefully that's not cheating, but that was very kind of him. So thank you, Robert. And I know
it's research, Lily.
Yeah,
it's research.
Okay. And he always takes a really interesting angle. So what did he say? Who was the first celebrity for a drinks brand?
Well, so this didn't start out with celebrities creating their own brand so much as people naming their wines or vineyards, either to flatter themselves or to flatter somebody else or to connect to their influence. Mm-hmm. So there is some suggestion that this started with the Romans.
Okay, so a lot goes back to the Romans. Tell me more.
Yeah. So one of the top wines of the day was supposed to be something called Faustian Falernian. So Falernian was their favourite wine. It comes from Campania. And it was, but this particular wine that was very prized came from land owned by a guy called Faustus. Mm-hmm. But it seemed from writing at the time that it was just people referring to the vineyard, meaning it was from Faustus' land. And because he was prominent, the name stuck.
Okay. Okay. So not kind of celebrity endorsed, more celebrity linked, so not celebrity wine in the modern sense that we're talking about today.
Yeah, and there's a few examples of naming specific sites after famous people. So the most notable is probably Corton Charlemagne, mm-hmm. a prestigious Burgundian Grand Cru vineyard named after the Emperor Charlemagne, who once owned the hill, apparently.
Okay.
A legend claims that his wife disliked red wine staining his beard, and that's how it led to planting white vines in her honour, or that's the myth.
Okay, well, I'm very thankful to her as a big fan of Burgundian Chardonnay. So thank you, Mrs. Charlemagne.
Yeah, with a woman with good taste.
Yeah, she definitely is. So thinking about that, we could also... Okay, I have a question, which is, can we class popes as celebrities? Because
I think so.
Okay.
They're definitely celebrities.
Okay, then we can think about Châteauneuf du Pape, of course, named for the popes who were in Avignon at the time rather than Rome.
Yes, and we love the popes. They've been very big supporters of wine.
They have. Okay, I'm going to do one of my tangent, very small tangent times. So, fun fact incoming. Did you know that the Vatican City, which is technically a country, has the highest per capita consumption of wine of any country in the world? And they drink about 99 bottles of wine per person annually. So that means that the population, let's just be clear, is technically 800-ish people. So I'm wondering, is that because they all like drinking a lot, those 800 people, or is there a lot of this kind of going into communion wine, given that there's kind of quite a big trade in communion wine in the Vatican City?
I bet it doesn't. I bet that's wine they drink themselves. Because, you know, they have been very enthusiastic supporters of wine. So Pope Francis, for example, called it a gift from God.
And so right he was and is, which it is. Anyway, so what you were talking about earlier with these kind of connections between celebrities, we're talking about popes and Charlemagne and all of that. What we're talking about really here is the halo effect. So this is where, and that's what was sort of happening back in the day there. So this is where we believe that if someone is successful or attractive, we assume that they're competent in other areas as well. So if they endorse something or something's named after them, we assume they know what they're talking about, or that we transfer our positive feelings about that person to whatever they're involved in. So effectively, we're borrowing their personal brand equity.
Yeah, that's right. And I should say the first true celebrity wine of the modern era, as we would understand it, came from the actress Lily Langtry.
Okay, so she's the actress, wasn't she the mistress of the Prince of Wales and bought a French chateau? Do I remember that correctly?
No, it wasn't French.
Oh, okay.
Despite being rich and famous, she overspent. She went broke.
Oh, okay.
So she headed to California in the 1880s, and she was going to America so she could do tours and make money. But in 1891, she bought an estate north of Napa, and she'd have these huge parties, and she'd make sure the press came along, and so she'd serve her wine. And it ended up that the wine, then spread to other fashionable dinners in San Francisco. But that was very small scale compared to today.
Okay. I bet those parties were really good.
I bet they were amazing.
They were amazing. So, okay then. So when does the sort of modern era in celebrity drinks begin?
Well, it starts at a very particular time in 1978 when the wine producer Paul Masson hired Orson Welles to front their television ads.
Okay, so that would have been in the US, I'm assuming.
Yes, though he was eventually replaced with the British actor John Gielgud, who apparently said he would only do it if the ads weren't shown in Britain.
Okay, I'm not sure that's a really good sign for a brand ambassador when they try to distance themselves from the brand in their home country. But I'm guessing they worked if they were doing
them. Well, they did, but they almost didn't. Oh, okay. So Orson Welles was an extremely heavy drinker, and the outtakes of the ads can be found on YouTube. He's visibly intoxicated when they were trying to film. And so you've got this guy next to him whose job it is to open the bottle of wine, and he's just waiting and waiting and waiting because Orson Welles can't remember his lines.
Oh, okay. Not the greatest look for a brand ambassador for a drinks brand then. But if we're thinking about that in the context of celebrity, then celebrity is much broader than just being restricted to actors. So shall we have a go at defining what a celebrity is? Do you want to take a stab first?
Somebody who's really well known. It's not just pop singers and movie stars today. It would include TikTokers, digital creators, climate activists, famous entrepreneurs, Steve Jobs, Richard Branson, those sorts of things that are a bit edgy.
Yeah.
Just famous people, I guess.
Okay. So, yes. And I think building on that, one of the key points is that the notion of celebrity has changed. So there's this brilliant book written by an author called Graham Turner, who's a researcher and author, and the book's called Understanding Celebrity. And
can you raise your eyebrows about me reading books on fertiliser? Anyway, sorry.
I'd suggest there was more of a across the dinner party conversation about what's a celebrity than there is about fertiliser.
Fertiliser's amazing. All right.
But that's just my opinion. Anyway, so he wrote this fab book actually back in 2014, I believe, and it was called Understanding Celebrity. And he argues that celebrity is no longer just because you've got a talent, which means that celebrity is something that can be constructed, so by the media, by audiences, by platforms, and most importantly, by the celebrity themselves.
Yeah, I won't derail this right now. I'll derail it later. Remind you to tell you later about the time I commissioned someone to create a celebrity wine for themselves.
Okay, there's so much I want to ask about that, but let's not derail, as you say, right at the moment. I'm just going to hold off, but I do want to pick back up on that because there's just so many questions. So back to Turner and his book and trying to keep us on track. He categorizes celebrities in three types. So he says, first of all, you've got ascribed celebrity. So kind of think royalty or someone born into fame. So this is the sort of fame basically that you're born into, and that's a type of celebrity.
So we could call this Nepo celebrity.
We could, which would be a very succinct way of describing it. Yes. And then there's achieved celebrity. So as we were just discussing, so that's an actor, athlete, musician, et cetera, business person who's done something exceptional. So in this case, you kind of got to have skill and talent.
I say, so this is where my plan to become a celebrity kind of falls
down. Oh, no, Felicity, not at all, not at all. So the third type he talks about of celebrity is what he calls attributed celebrity. So this is, think, kind of reality TV stars and influencers.
Yeah, and I should say the great thing about, well, if you're a celebrity, the great thing about being a celebrity is that you can now measure it. You can measure fame in likes, follows, comments, and you can take those measurements and you can parlay them into sponsorship deals and so on.
Mm. Yeah, and there's another great author, academic author actually, in this area, Alice Marwick, and she studied what she calls the kind of, or what's called the attention economy. So she makes the point that in a world saturated with content, which we live in, what gets noticed is what has value. So therefore, that value is monetizable.
Okay. And does she offer any tips for podcasters?
Are you asking for a friend?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So if you were asking for us, I reckon she'd advise us to become micro celebrities inside our own niche and then expand from there. Or perhaps, Felicity, we could use her concept of luxury selfie. So this is where influence signals status and aspiration through images of, like, you know, being on a private jet or designer clothes and brands or sipping rosé on yachts. So it's this kind of visual shorthand for success.
Did you know that people go and hire fake personal jets, like personal jet sets, just so they can sit inside them and film themselves doing luxury selfies?
Again, Felicity, speaking from experience...
No, okay. I read about it somewhere.
Of course you did. Okay. Anyway, get us back again to drinks brands. So with a celebrity brand, you're not just buying the drinks brand effectively. When we were talking about the halo impact previously, you're buying sort of a bit of them. So it's super important that you're connecting with their awareness, their brand awareness, personal brand awareness, also their positioning, and you're getting effectively this brand equity by proxy.
Yeah, so basically they're a brand nesting inside another brand.
Yeah, yeah. So at risk of you laughing at me, one of my favourite academic journals, as we talk about.
I'm holding it back.
Yeah, I'm holding it back.
Thank you. Carry on.
So Journal of Marketing, you know, it's one of my favourites. Anyway, there was, again, a great study, again, written quite a few years ago by Morrison Thompson, and they talked about the concept of human brands. So celebrities, they argue, function just as traditional brands do, with this idea of building equity, trust and brand loyalty.
Yeah, and one thing we haven't touched on is also the so-called parasocial relationship, where you develop a one-sided relationship with a celebrity, and you treat them like a friend. Anyway, so to sum up, fame today is constructed, data-driven and commercial. It's not just about being famous by right of birth or because you're a movie star. It's about how you're known, who you reach and what you do with that attention.
So I love it when you sum up all my ramblings, Felicity. Once the editor, always an editor. Thank you.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Okay, so now we've defined celebrity. Would you like to take us through what is a celebrity brand?
Okay, so we can think about this basically in three layers of connection or hierarchy. So first up, we've got celebrity founders. So these are celebrities who co-found or co-own the brand and kind of get stuck into the creative decision. So here we can think Casamigos Tequila, co-founded in 2013 by George Clooney, Randy Gerber and Michael Meldman. We'll come on to more of them and that later. But just to give us that context, just 4 years later in 2017, they sold the brand to Diageo for a reported $700 million upfront, with a potential of an additional $300 million based on performance milestones.
Wow. Okay, so my personal favourite of a celebrity founding a brand was from Danny DeVito.
Oh, okay.
Who appeared on The View in 2006. And he sort of was in, shall we say, pretty bad shape.
Okay.
And he explained it by saying it was the last seven limoncellos that did it. And it got so much publicity that he went off and he actually created a limoncello brand.
Is the brand still around?
No. What happened? He sold 50,000 cases, but people said it was too sweet. It wasn't sort of, didn't have the balance of the Italian ones, so it sort of came and went. But it was very authentically linked to him, that's for sure.
Okay, I'm going to sidebar. So limoncello, we're just talking about limoncello. So we do have, as always, you know, we've talked previously about what's at the back of your drinks cabinet, limoncello being at the back of ours. I've just discovered limoncello spritz. Who knew?
Oh, they're going off. They're huge in Australia.
Oh, my God. I so love it. It's become a thing in our house. Anyway, so celebrities. So these moments, you were talking about Danny DeVito there and I was talking about Casamigos. So these moments turn out to be massive drivers of celebrity brands. So do you remember, Felicity, around the time that the rapper Jay-Z publicly boycotted the Champagne Cristal after the then managing director said that hip hop was unwelcome attention to the brand?
I certainly do. And we did a story about that.
Of course you did. Of course you did. Yeah. So he dropped Cristal from his clubs and personal promotion and then switched his allegiance, shall we say, to Krug and Dom Perignon, and then started promoting a brand called Ace of Spades. Do you remember that? Which he ultimately acquired.
Yes, and just to show how massive a mistake Cristal made, Ace of Spades is currently valued at about $630 million. So Jay-Z ultimately sold a 50% share to the luxury house LVMH in 2014, which is a big mistake. So it shows the power of celebrity. All right, what else have we got?
Okay, so next on our hierarchy, so we had founders first. Next, we've got co-creators or investors. So these people might hold equity, they might help shape the brand or the brand voice, but they're not involved in kind of day-to-day operational. So Ryan Reynolds, for example, really good example of this with Aviation Gin. Again, we'll come back to him and Aviation Gin.
I think this is our path forward, Lily. A Question of Drinks needs investors and co-creators. If that's you, listener, get in touch. You know the Gmail address. Okay.
You're
what
on
else,
a
Lily?
Roll today, aren't you, Felicity, trying to expand our podcast. Anyway.
No, I'm trying to extract money from our listeners. Okay. Help me out.
Okay. Fair. Okay, so third one. So we've had our founders, co-creators. So the third one are effectively endorsements. Yeah, kind of advertising. So these are traditional brand ambassadors. So here we can think David Beckham, for example, and Hey Club. Again, we'll come on to that in a moment. So his job was basically to show up, look suave and sip whiskey.
Yes, but he's not directing the marketing strategy or helping out with the design or anything like that.
No, and what's interesting is actually you see that sometimes people start off more in this ambassador role and then they kind of become more connected and, you know, may end up actually taking a stake in the business or deeper collaboration. So an example of this would be Matthew McConaughey, who started basically as the face of Wild Turkey, but actually later then took on a creative director role and became much more engaged with the brand.
Okay, so just to sum up, when we're talking about celebrity drinks brands, what we're actually asking is who's behind the bottle and to what level they're involved.
Yeah, and that's really important because the level of involvement often impacts how consumers perceive the product, how long the brand lasts, and whether it's truly scalable.
Yeah. Okay, so as you know, there's this huge debate within the wine and spirits world about whether these celebrity brands are good for the sector or whether they're just driving other brands off the shelf. So some professionals have really strong views about what they see as interlopers busting into their categories. So it's worth looking at why this is such a big controversy.
So for this part of the episode, the blue corner is the view that celebrity brands are good for the drinks industry, and the red corner view says they are not good for the drinks industry.
So, and as I said, I'm going to be the contrarian and take the red corner.
Okay. So if you'll forgive me, let's start with the positive view. Let's go blue. So in the blue corner, what we're looking for is evidence that celebrities bring new drinkers to the category or reinvigorate a category in some way, which is what the professionals are always focusing on.
Yes. And so the question is whether the celebrity can do that without cannibalizing what already exists.
Yeah. So the first and probably most obvious point then is that because celebrities have this, we were talking about earlier, this built-in high levels of personal brand awareness, they bring that with them and they can therefore potentially bring audiences who are not typical potentially in the category or aware of the brand or aware of that specific category. So two examples I just referenced previously. So the first one was George Clooney and his mates with Casamigos Tequila. They created it in 2013, apparently as a private tequila for drinking with friends. So the story goes. So they spent many a night apparently conducting tequila research at their vacation compound in Baja Peninsula in Mexico. And it, as we know, Roll the Clock Forward has turned into a massive brand that's really helped popularize premium tequila, which we've seen a lot of growth in over the last 5 years or so. So as we said earlier, it was sold for, you know, near a billion with the earnout to Diageo literally 4 years later.
What's really interesting about this is at the time that it was launched, Clooney was under a lot of pressure for his role in Nespresso, according to the New York Times.
Okay, I didn't know there was an issue with his advertising in Nespresso. So I thought it was kind of iconic advertising.
Well, so did I until I read about it.
Okay.
So it was sort of seen as him, you know, kind of, yeah. No, in fact, Clooney only got involved because the ads were showing outside the US, but it was the early days of streaming. And so pretty quickly Americans could see the ads and they all called him a sellout.
Oh.
And there's actually this video of him online doing a profanity-laced rant about all the people who criticized him. All right. So anyway, he laughed all the way in the bank. Yeah. So who's the next example?
So I referenced earlier Ryan Reynolds, who bought into aviation gin in 2018 and then used his kind of personal brand, you know, his sort of quirkiness as part of the brand positioning. So he's credited with helping the entire premium gin category grow in the US. So if you remember at the time, premium gin was not as big and growth in the US as it was in markets like the UK and Spain and other places. So he's really credited with supporting that growth in premium gin. Again, sold to Diageo in 2020 for reportedly estimated over $600 million upfront, and then again, a hefty earnout.
Okay, and finally, we should mention Brangelina.
Yes, so I'm glad you reminded me. So Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie's Chateau Miraval, so widely credited again with helping to turbocharge the global rosé boom, well, particularly at the premium end, should we say.
Yeah, apparently they saw it because they were flying over these properties in a helicopter and they liked it. So in 2008, they leased it for 3 years. In 2011, they bought it outright and then they got married there in 2014.
Yeah. And if you remember when we were talking about rosé in our previous episode, which we talked about Provence Rosé, which was already growing as a category at this time, but largely much more seasonal rather than year-round and pretty price-sensitive, so we didn't really have the luxury end. So what Miraval helped do was prove that rosé can be positioned as a luxury year-round drink. So it also appeared in Wine Spectator's top wine lists and remains one of the few celebrity wines that we could say is taken so seriously by critics.
Well, it's because of who makes it. Yeah. So it's the Perrin family of Beaucastel fame. They make the wine, and apparently the first release, which came out in 2013, sold out in an hour in France. But this story all comes to a bad end.
Story, yes. Wine's still popular, though. Brand's still popular.
Okay. So when Brangelina got divorced, they ended up fighting over the property. And in 2021, Angelina Jolie sold 50% of her stake to a subsidiary of the Stolle Group, you know, with the vodka group, and which Brad Pitt claimed violated a prior agreement. She then accused him of a, quote, vindictive campaign to, quote, loot the property, and Vogue called it the War of the Roses.
Okay. Love that. So who won?
Do you know, I haven't been able to find out. So it might be that the dispute is ongoing. Anyway, so we could also add lots of other celebrities whose products have done very well. I think the ones that we're talking about, though, are the people who've changed the category for the better.
Yeah, and I think that's why we kind of picked out, or we're talking about those particular examples, because they've not just had an impact on the brand itself, but as you say, it's actually potentially quite a significant impact on those specific categories. Anyway.
That's right. So in these cases, the wine trade should be pretty happy that they got involved.
Yeah, because they promoted, supported the growth of the categories in general. But Felicity, it's time for the red corner, time for you to be across, angry and curmudgeonly. Talk us through the disasters.
Okay, so these are legion, but probably the one that exemplifies the problem is the Trump vodka debacle.
Okay. Hey, share. Go on.
Okay. So what I'm about to read actually comes from an American conservative magazine called The Federalist, and they wrote a piece about it in 2016. And they said, quote, "It is a capitalist paradox that the very brand name Trump has become representative of perceived excellence while carrying the palpable tincture of broad failure. His brand instills a product with all the perceived qualities of lavishness while imbuing it with the promise of doomed culmination."
Okay. I love that quote, because the words in there, doomed culmination. Those are two very good words to use together. But tell us what happened.
So basically the vodka was launched in 2005 and, according to the same article, was actually quite good.
Oh, okay.
The author tracked down some bottles and said, quote, "Made from select European wheat, the spirit was distilled 5 times, then aged for 6 months, followed by multiple filtrations prior to bottling. It has a crisp body, very clean finish and a not unpleasant aroma. This is what you expect from a high-end vodka."
Okay. Maybe it's because I'm contextualizing my comment here in 2025, but I was not expecting that. I thought that it would be a terrible vodka, but also you mentioned it was European. That doesn't make sense.
Yeah. It was an American brand that was originally made in the Netherlands. I've got no idea why.
Okay.
And then production moved to Germany by Drinks America. So, but here's the thing. Trump told Larry King that he'd entered the premium vodka market because, quote, "A great friend of mine was a founder of Grey Goose. Mm. And what we're going to do is top it. I want to top them just because it's fun to top my friends." End
nice.
Of quote. Now I'm quoting from the Federalist article again, quote, "Thus his foray into the premium spirits market was not a dedication to creating a quality product. It was a screw you to one of his buddies." Okay, but there was a much bigger problem than his motivation.
Okay, I'm on tenterhooks. Go.
Okay, so, well, Trump is famously a non-drinker, so he doesn't understand the drinks market. So he told the media that he expected the Trump and tonic to become the most popular cocktail in the country.
Okay, so, of course, let's contextualise this. So in Western countries, so including the US, vodka primarily, overwhelmingly, is used as a base spirit in cocktails and mixed drinks. So think, you know, classics like Cosmo, Screwdriver, Vodka Martini, Bloody Mary, Moscow Mule. So yes, it is consumed as a vodka tonic, but there's way more is consumed in other ways. So this isn't reflective of the category and how it's consumed.
That's right. So he didn't understand the product he was selling. And of course, he wasn't really a very authentic, brand ambassador for a vodka brand. And the other problem was that it was really, really expensive. At the time, it was $35 for a bottle, and that was considered too much. So basically, the brand lasted all of 2 years, and that was that.
Okay. So we were talking about categories earlier and impact on these celebrity brands on categories. So did this damage the vodka category?
No, it didn't. But I wanted to shoehorn that story in because I think it's delightful.
Okay.
It didn't enhance the category. Why don't we say that?
Okay. When it comes to then questions of damage, so what we're just talking about there, we can't go without mentioning a recent endorser that took down at what the time had been the number one best-selling light beer in the US market for over 20 years.
Yes, this is really something that killed a category. So you must be referring to the Bud Light debacle.
I am the very same. So I remembered when that happened, I nearly got neck ache from shaking my head so much about it.
Do you want to tell the story?
I will. Okay, I'll try and keep it as the short version because it is quite a long story, but super, super interesting. So the short version, April 2023, Bud Light, as I said at the time, which was and had been for many years the number one light beer, being a very huge category of beer in the US, sent transgender TikTok influencer Dylan Mulvaney personalized cans to celebrate her transition milestone. So Dylan, wasn't singled out for this. They sent cans personalized to all sorts of influencers, all sorts of people, part of a massive integrated marketing campaign. So she made a short post, saying that she'd sort of celebrating her transition, cheers, and just literally went cheers with a personalized can or Bud Light. But it triggered the hugest conservative backlash, including social media outrage, bomb threats at Budweiser facilities, and public stunts like Kid Rock firing Bud Light cases with a submachine gun.
Yeah, I was actually following that at the time. It was absolutely brutal.
It did
come at the height of that sort of culture war period. So sales just collapsed. There were cartons piling up in stores. People were trying to give them away and they couldn't. And the parent company, AB InBev, stock tumbled 20%, which in real terms meant they lost billions in market value. So, Luli, what does this say about celebrity branding?
Okay, so much of it has to do with positioning, connection, and target audience. So in this case, the post, as we were just saying, it was one really, really short TikTok post by one influencer of many and small change compared to the annual advertising and marketing spend of Bud Light. But the relatively newly appointed marketing director at the time for Bud Light was interviewed just before that TikTok was released. And she talked about being bought into the brand as Bud Light had been losing market share for a number of years, even though it was still number one at this point. She said it was her job to get younger consumers on board, hence she bringing in collaborations with people like Dylan Mulvaney.
Yeah, I remember. So there were two problems. One was that there was a lot of social media chatter before this that Bud Light wasn't actually that, sort of tasty anymore compared to what else was on the market. But the other problem was she was actually a bit dismissive and condescending about Bud Light's existing audience, which was working class men from middle and rural America.
Yeah, absolutely. And what she didn't take into account was that Bud Light was it's a mainstay all-American brand. So she effectively alienated the current core target audience, which was already shrinking anyway. And this became, as you were just referring to earlier, really quickly kind of politicized, as Dylan, we were talking about earlier, is transgender and therefore, not necessarily aligned with the values of their core target audience.
Yeah, and it wasn't aligned with the values of Bud Light either. We should say that Bud Light actually threw Dylan Mulvaney under the bus. Dylan Mulvaney, I think, had to get security and protection and just got nothing from Bud Light. So I guess the takeaway from all of this is if the celebrity has a real stake in what they're promoting, it can not only work for them personally, it can also help build the category.
Yes, but get it wrong, it either sinks without trace or it can blow up in your face.
All right. This is the point that I'm going to tell you about the time I helped create a celebrity brand.
Oh, yes. I forgot. How could I have forgotten about that? And I'm guessing this was for an article, Felicity.
It was. It was in 2022. And at that time, there was a celebrity brand popping up every 5 minutes. So I commissioned an American drinks writer, Aaron Goldfarb, who is absolutely brilliant. And he's a teeny tiny celebrity in his own right because he'd been on television once.
Well, he's not a very little person. He's just been on television once.
His level of celebrity. He should be a high level of celebrity. But anyway, he was teeny tiny at the time. Okay. So I commissioned him to go and create his own wine brand to see how difficult it was. And the first person he talked to said he would need a budget of about $15 million to get any kind of market traction.
Okay. I'm guessing you didn't give him $15
million. No, he got $300. Okay, and I spent $50 on a graphic designer for Fiverr getting a label done. So we got a photo of his Brooklyn apartment and we put it on the label etched in blue.
Okay. And so sourcing wine, you're not really going to be able to source very much for your remaining $250, Felicity.
Well, he went to a supplier of natural wines who were able to do a very, very small bottling run and they had 12 grape varieties on offer to choose from.
Okay, so which one did he choose?
Well, he wasn't a wine writer and he didn't know what to choose, so he got a bit of all of them. So reds, whites, everything went in.
They're all in.
Yeah, he did. So he got 50 bottles made and he took it to a distributor and they had to open a bottle to try it, which meant he had only had 49 left to sell.
Okay, it's like there's like 10 green bottles or something.
Yeah, that's right.
It's like, okay, so how did he go?
Well, they took it on. And, you know, maybe it was for the story, not just for the quality of the wine. But after we ran the story, all 49 sold out immediately, which was $50 a bottle, I think. So we called it a great success. So it could be done. We could do it, Luli. What great variety would you be?
Oh, God, Chardonnay, through and through. You know me, Chardonnay girl, absolutely every day of the week. What about you?
Oh, something acidic. Riesling, probably. Something that snaps. Or maybe I'd be a gin and tonic.
Okay, so acidic, clearly not referring to your personality, Felicity. Just the wine. Okay, so we've talked a lot about celebrity. We've talked about types of celebrity. We've talked about the history of celebrity drinks brands. We've talked about when things go well, when things don't go so well. So let's finish up with a rapid fire section. Well, as rapid fire as we can ever get. Anyway, I've come up with a quiz and I'm really, really, really excited. I've come up with like a quiz show style that we can do. Can we do it?
We can. Yeah?
So you ready? We kind of almost need like a drum roll. So Felicity, let's play. Ready? Hall of Fame or Hall of Shame?
Okay, I'm all in. I will go along with any project that you come up with, but I just need you to know that if this is about contemporary celebrities, I might be a bit hopeless.
Okay. Thank you. So this is how, for indulging me. So this is how it works. I'm going to name a celebrity drinks brand and all you have to do is go Hall of Fame or Hall of Shame. So here goes. So let's start with probably one of the most well-known and famous celebrity drinks brands from Australia. See, I'm being kind to you on your celebrity knowledge here. Kylie Minogue wines, fame or shame?
Oh, fame. She's iconic. I hope she goes down in history as one of the great contributors to wine.
Oh, brilliant. I'm so glad you said that because I completely agree. Completely agree. So
no, forget caught on Charlemagne. We've got Kylie.
Yeah, we've got Kylie. So 16% share. I mentioned it earlier of UK sparkling wine market.
It's a lot.
It's a lot. 15 million bottles sold, distributed in over 30 countries. But what I think is so brilliant about her wine, remembering it's rosé and sparkling, is what she focuses on, is her personality fit. Remember we were talking about with Dylan Mulvaney, that kind of unfit between the brand and the personality. But whereas in the case of Kylie, it just so fits neatly with what the wine is. And clearly you've been many a time like I have, Provine, the wonderful large in huge hall trade fair in the delight of Düsseldorf.
In winter,
which you can't get to because there's no transport. She showed up there. So this is
Do you know how I remember that? Because there was a crowd of middle-aged men around her wanting to get their photograph with her.
Look, I credit to the girl. She shows up in the middle of winter in Düsseldorf at a very boring trade. I didn't say that out loud. Boring trade show. Lots of really exciting stuff happens. And she, you know, in her pink frilly dress, and she was promoting the hell out of her wine. So absolutely good on her. And my last thing I would say is that because she has really strong, high level of brand awareness and her target market's basically anyone over the age of 45 and the LGBTQ+ community. But I do wonder, Felicity, are we such fangirls because of our age and because we understand who Kylie is and we grew up with her? So I did a fact check with our in-house Gen Z correspondent.
Oh, yes, yes, your homegrown Gen Z research team. So yes. Does she know of Kylie? And if so, what are her views?
So she does. So I interviewed her and her girlfriend over dinner, to your point, a couple of nights ago. And their immediate reactions were, Kylie is the ultimate diva. So remembering they're 22 years old. So they said that the rosé and sparkling was so fitting with their perception, personality of Kylie. And they said, and I'll quote them, they both said, Kylie Minogue, both personally and her wines, are the ultimate go out to brunch wines. And they also then added that her wines would be brilliant for a drag brunch. So they rounded up by saying, perfect wine for the girls and the gays.
Yeah. She's an icon in the gay community in Sydney. So her branded wines were only launched in 2020 by industry veteran Paul Schaafsma, who's MD of Benchmark Wine in the UK, though he is an Aussie and therefore he understands the power of Kylie.
He does, and that's right. And Paul has praised Kylie's dedication. We were just talking about when she showed up at this rather dull trade show. Her dedication to the project, noting that she takes her role really seriously. She's, you know, kind of studying wine, traveling globally to promote the brand, and most importantly, treating it like a sort of lifelong endeavor rather than simply a sort of short-term vanity project. So interestingly, Benchmark Wines have since launched other celebrity wines. So ready for this? Okay. Gordon Ramsay.
Yeah, that sounds like a fit with wine.
Okay. Gary Barlow.
No opinion.
No opinion. Okay. Graham Norton.
No opinion.
Okay. Sarah Jessica Parker.
Sounds like a rosé waiting to happen.
Okay, cool. Anyway, so they've got the other ones. Right, next up in our fame or shame. You ready for this one?
Let's go.
So let's now go for an endorsed brand, because we were talking about endorsed brands as well as sort of owned brands. So Hey Club Whiskey, David Beckham, fame or shame?
Do you know, I actually don't know, but I'm guessing that since we've done a fame, this one has to be a shame.
Well, this is a little bit controversial, seeing as I am both a huge whiskey fan and also a David Beckham fan. So I'm afraid I'm going to have to put this one into shame.
Okay. Do explain why.
Okay. So it was launched with Beckham as its face in 2014. Sales hit pretty quickly by 2015, according to industry sources, around $50 million. But more or less stayed there. Their best year, again, according to the industry sources I can find, say that sales peaked in 2021 with US dollar sales of around 64 million, but it has come down a third by then, industry estimates suggest, and Beckham ended his partnership in 2023.
Oh, no, they've slid from 64 million to about 40 million. That's what a disaster. What
I know,
a
disaster. Disaster.
Yeah, definitely Hall of Shame time.
Well, I suppose it's I'm putting it in Hall of Shame because it's you could go fame because, you know, they sold lots, great, you know, they've made a sort of short-term brand. I'm putting it in shame because it hasn't got that longevity, which I actually believe Kylie's wines will have for the reasons we explained. But there was also quite a big backlash, particularly from kind of whiskey bloggers and whiskey drinkers who named it, if you read this, they called it the blue aftershave. because
that's definitely Hall of Shame.
That's
time.
Not good because no, of the packaging and the aroma. both. So there was massive early spend from Diageo, but it just didn't get that connection that we were talking about, because casual whiskey drinkers kind of didn't get it, that disconnection between David Beckham as personality and whiskey. He famously is not a big drinker either.
That's the Trump vodka problem all over again.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's kind of true though, because he is famously not a big drinker.
So it kind of sits
into the red corner where there's that authenticity gap. So, but I wonder whether they were trying to actually link in more to Asia markets by getting him as the ambassador.
Okay, so I'm not sure the connection there. You'll have to explain it.
Okay. Yeah. So I remember a senior person from Conchiatura, so the Chilean wine producer who makes a very well-known brand, Casillero del Diablo brand, telling me that when they as a brand sponsored Manchester United football team, so the UK football team, English football team, was not to gain awareness and traction in the UK, but because English football is so followed passionately in Asian markets, but particularly in China, which was a market they were trying to grow in at the time.
Ah, tricky. So there's a whole interesting strategy. Yeah. All right, so I've got one for you.
Okay.
Meghan Markle has just launched a rosé from Napa called As Ever. Fame or shame?
Oh, I can't believe you put me on the spot like that. And you want me to fess up about my opinion of Meghan Markle and whether
I'm Team Markle or not. I'm going to save you from having to air your personal views. We're going to ground this in fact.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
So here's the story. Her As Ever wines are part of her As Ever brand, which is tied to her Netflix series, right? So it's part of a whole brand rollout. Mm. So the first wine release was in July this year, and the second drop happened on the 5th of August, and it sold out in the first 10 minutes, according to Harper's Bazaar. That means 10,000 bottles. A spokesperson for the brand said that 20% of the buyers were repeat customers.
Okay, so Cynic Luli coming in here loud and strong. If that's direct sales, so DTC, there's no way of externally validating any of those numbers about
repeat
and bottle sales.
Right, so Cynic Felicity is going to tell you what else was in that Harper Bazaar article. The same spokesperson said, quote, "Our products are created with love, shared with meaning, connecting people through life's special moments, big and small. We want every customer to delight in owning a piece of As Ever." So I think we can sidestep the question of Team Meghan or not and just say that, I guess anything that drains the wine lake in the US right now is a good thing, even if sold with extraordinary sentimentality.
So I'm going to remain without comment and just leave that last quote hanging there, Felicity.
We want every customer to delight in owning a piece of As Ever. Okay, so now that we're in the zone, let's just wrap up what we've learned about celebrities in wine and spirits.
Okay, so trying to pull myself back together. Okay, the lesson is fame is the spark, not the fire. So,
that's very deep.
Did you like that?
You've been inspired by my quote.
I know, but I'm just kind of following on.
You're riffing.
I'm going to go with it. I'm going to roll with it, Felicity. So the fit between the celebrity, as we've been talking about, and the product really matters. And there has to be that real connection between the two of them. So just slapping a name and an image on it doesn't necessarily work. And it can create disaster.
As my now favourite example, the Trump vodka debacle shows, quality won't save you. But you do need quality if you want to hit. So, Luli, just to answer the question that sparked this episode, are celebrities selling a real drink or are they selling just a story?
Well, you knew I was going to, as always, go both. My on-the-fence typical answer. So, with celebrities earning up to $1 billion, them and the other shareholders, so no doubt that they have as well, but still, let's call it just lots of money. When they finally sell, as per George Clooney et al., the real question is probably why aren't there more celebrity brands around? So it's all back to this awareness. And borrowing the halo effect and that brand equity and the awareness, which we know is the key metric that correlates to volume and sales growth. So we just need to keep thinking about this awareness and the fact that with celebrities, when appropriate, believed, connected, immediately improve that awareness, which is a big driver for growth. And we talked earlier about it can not only just happen for the brand itself, but actually impact a whole category.
Yes. So that comes to our second question of the trade, do these things cannibalize the market or do they grow the market? And obviously, if they're done well, they can grow the market, but it will all fall apart if it's a naked cash grab, because lovers of the category will either ignore you or you'll burn through a lot of cash or you'll make them really angry, as with Bud Light. So the question for us is, Luli, shall we do a celebrity drink?
If the right celebrity comes along, definitely, because we know what we're doing now-ish.
Yeah, we do.
So who do you think would be best?
So not Trump. Okay. I think the obvious celebrity for us is Kylie. I think she needs to add a Luli Chardonnay to her range.
Ah, okay, but she's kind of already got a deal. But yes,
oh, she needs another one.
So do you know her? Can we give her a call?
I don't. Australia is a small country, but I don't have her number. But maybe somebody else does.
Okay. So if you know Kylie, give us a call.
Yes. Maybe. And while you're working hard on our behalf, please don't forget to leave a rating for the podcast because it helps the algorithm. And when I say rating, I mean a nice rating.
Mm. Yes. So this has been a question of drinks. Don't forget, if you want to ask us another question, please drop us a line at aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com. And as always, I'll read them and maybe I'll share some of them with Felicity. You've been listening to A Question of Drinks, the podcast that explores why we drink what we do.
And we're here to answer your questions. If you want to know more about anything drinks, from the marketing history to the economic underpinnings as to why this drink is popular and not that one, send us an email.
Send any questions you'd like us to discuss, and quite frankly, the more random and niche the better, and we'll have a go at answering them. We can be reached on aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com. That's aquestionofdrinks, all one word, @gmail.com.
And we would hugely appreciate you reviewing and rating this podcast before you go. 5 stars are much appreciated.